It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. 100 years ago this year, the film The Birth of a Nation made a debut in theaters around the United States. The film was a technical masterpiece by the auteur D.W. Griffith. It was a hit at the box office. Over 25 million went to see it. That's a lot of people at that time. It was an innovative spectacle over 3 hours long, and it was also, by today's standards, hate speech. Birth of a Nation is an extremely racist film, and even in 1915, it upset a lot of people. There were even riots. Journalist and author Dick Lehr has written about the movie, the controversy, and the clash of two men who presented two very different views of America in his book called The Birth of a Nation. We welcome Dick Lehr to the show. Dick, thanks for being with us.
Sure, happy to be here, Steve.
The movie was a success when it was released. What made Birth of a Nation such a big hit?
Well, in 1915, when D.W. Griffith premiered Birth of a Nation, Americans had never seen anything like it. It was a three-hour-plus epic feature film, which, again, this is at the front end of this new medium called film. And everything prior to that, that people were used to seeing were Nickelodeon's very brief, short things. So first of all, you had the scope and the scale of this drama, the long-form feature film. And then the other big thing is that Griffith brought to bear filmmaking techniques that audiences also hadn't experienced. Most films then had been made with a stationary camera kind of just pointing at a stage, and the actors moved around in front of it. Griffith pioneered the idea of shooting a scene from multiple angles, having the master shot, then changing the point of view. And that's just one example of a number of techniques that he used that heightened the cinematic experience for viewers. So you had all that in the mix. And I think the last big thing is that his topic was huge. It was the American Civil War and Reconstruction. And in 1915, that was still a very big story.
It was the first film to depict the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. It was definitely part of the American story and mythology and psyche at the time.
Absolutely. And here you have that assassination in the context of this sweeping drama about, you know, the Civil War and then the Reconstruction and in the aftermath, and President Lincoln through the war and his assassination. So it was astonishing material and astonishingly portrayed.
The movie was heavily hyped as well, and a lot of that hype came from D.W. Griffith himself.
Indeed it was. I mean, he was his own best publicist in so many ways, and in some ways he didn't even need to do it. I mean, he talked about having thousands of extras and the budget of millions of dollars in those days. And all those were, you know, exaggerations that were unnecessary, given that it was such an amazing piece of filmmaking.
Well, the film itself is the black characters in it are depicted as cartoons and villains, and the cavalry that comes in at the end. Spoiler alert for any of
right.
those want to see this movie, don't want to be spoiled. The cavalry that comes in at the end is the Ku Klux Klan.
We've been talking about the amazing filmmaking skills that Griffith brought to bear, but obviously the big twist is what you're getting at is that his depiction of ex-slaves freed blacks is also astonishingly abhorrent. It's racist to the core. Freed blacks are seen as kind of animals incapable of exercising the voting rights that they've obtained through, you know, as a result of the Civil War. They're unworthy of freedom. Reconstruction is seen as a lawless and chaotic mess. And into that rides the Ku Klux Klan to restore order to the chaos that the ex-slaves had wrought.
So at this time, around the time of The Birth of a Nation's release, there was even legislature in Congress that was aimed to keep black people from immigrating into the United States. At the time, the temperature of the nation very much met some of the depictions in Griffith's film.
Absolutely. That's what's, again, you know, this is why the film is not only a milestone in cinematic history and is usually the starting point for any film survey course in college on American film because of the techniques that we've been alluding to, but it's also this, you know, in some ways, civil and sociological artifact because it was so enormously successful. It was America's first blockbuster film. People were in awe of the drama that they saw. They're on their feet cheering the Klan. And I just think that captures, as you just said, the temperature of America, generally speaking, was racist to a hotter degree perhaps than today. Or, I mean, this is a major theme in American life. But in all walks of life at the time, there was this embedded racism, and that was validating Griffith's views. And in history, for example, the leading American historians were writing that Reconstruction was a disaster, and it was a disaster because blacks were a lower form of humanity. So that there was that. And then there was, in science, there were plenty of studies that were later proved to be bogus and flawed, showing that the brains of black men were smaller than the brains of white men, and they were therefore inferior. So in all these different angles, you had this stuff that was just kind of, from our perspective today, and we still have a lot of, obviously, racial exclusion and issues, but, you know, just it's sort of mind-boggling and jaw-dropping to sort of start to get your arms around 1915.
Well, when you look at the anachronistic nature of The Birth of a Nation, the film, and some of those depictions, it's not surprising to see because of the evolution of our country and of attitudes. But maybe what is surprising is to see the pushback against it. This is the part of the story you tell I didn't know anything about, and is maybe one of the more fascinating aspects of the story of how The Birth of a Nation was received when it was released. William Monroe Trotter was the editor of a Boston newspaper. He was a Harvard graduate, extremely accomplished, but he became, for his time, a civil rights activist because of the opportunity that he didn't find once he graduated from Harvard. This was 1915. How did he organize against the screening of The Birth of a Nation?
This is the heart of the book that I wrote about this historic film, because I had not realized, as you're just saying, the degree to which the protest against the movie had been played out. And I didn't find anything that really brought that story out. So I really look at my book as a protest drama. And at the forefront is William Monroe Trotter, a civil rights leader and newspaper editor here in Boston. And at the time, and it's, part of it's a rediscovery of Trotter, because what I've learned is at the time in early 1900s, he was a nationally prominent black leader, mentioned in the same breath as W.E.B. Du Bois or Booker T. Washington. And being Harvard's first black Phi Beta Kappa, he and many black leaders and many of their white supporters were appalled at the depiction of black Americans in Griffith's film. And in fact, there is no one reflected in the film who is like a Trotter, who was Harvard-educated, first black Phi Beta Kappa. They don't exist in Griffith's world, you know? And so in some ways, here's Trotter, the living version of, like, what's all that's wrong with your movie, Mr. Griffith? And with the very young, still very young NAACP, Trotter in Boston was at the forefront of a protest against the film that remarkably played out over 3 months. The film had opened in February in L.A. to some protest. It moved to New York City in March. And then it headed to Boston, which has an abolitionist history and whatnot. And even the filmmakers Griffith and the producers said, if we can get the film through Boston, we can play it anywhere. And what they met in Boston was something that, once you drill down and dig it and make it come alive again, it's like something out of the 1960s. I kept scratching my head because there are days where there are 3,000-4,000 blacks and their supporters marching on the Massachusetts State House in protest against the film. Trotter led a protest at the Tremont Theater in downtown near Boston Common. We were met by over 100 Boston police, and there was a near riot, and Trotter and about 8 or 9 other people were arrested trying to force their way into the lobby of the film. This was not how the civil rights movement was operating at the time. Trotter was insisting on a new strategy of direct action to get in the white man's face, and that was unprecedented at the time.
Trotter's attempt to have the movie not shown, his attempt to have the movie withdrawn, at the time, the hammer of censorship came down pretty readily in Boston and in other places. So for Trotter to say, don't show this movie, it's racist, falls in line with the fact that at the time a lot of things were censored, and it would seem that it was not as judicious as one would think, trying to protect the welfare of the Commonwealth. That's something that had been happening. I mean, censorship was something that had been applied towards books and plays in Boston at the time.
Yeah, and even around the country. And that was one of the, to me, wonderful complications of this story, because, again, from our perspective 100 years later, censorship is the naughty word. You know, I mean, you know, I'm a journalist, and here Trotter's a journalist. I'm a First Amendment person, you know. It can be messy, but fight speech with speech and all that kind of stuff. in the early 1900s, there was an earlier version and a narrow version of free speech rights and First Amendment rights that you have to, again, kind of, if I did my job, I recreated that environment. And in that environment, the idea of censoring something, and he could have used this phrase, but it wasn't in vogue then, he was basically calling the film hate speech and arguing that the First Amendment is not absolute and not without limits, and something this offensive and this that provokes violence and encourages audiences to perhaps go out and lynch black people goes beyond the pale. And so it's this wonderful opportunity then also to explore the tensions between civil liberties and free speech rights. And it's all in this very much dramatic stages in the courts, on the streets, in the state house. And Trotter's in the middle of it, this, you know, smart, thinking, educated newspaper man trying to try new civil rights strategies. It's stuff that's really been forgotten. You know, obviously I found fascinating and wanted to bring back to life.
We're talking with Dick Lehr. He is a journalist and the author of The Birth of a Nation, which is the story of the controversial D.W. Griffith film, which debuted in 1915, and the protests against it. So, Dick, when there were people that wanted to censor Griffith's film, what was his reaction to the attempts of censorship?
Well, he opposed it vehemently, and he wrapped himself up in the First Amendment argument of this is artistic expression, and this is America, and he felt that it was also accurate. He didn't get it. He didn't understand why someone like Trotter and a lot of the black leaders would be so appalled by it. He felt it was an accurate portrayal of history as he knew it. And in many ways, that was Griffith's world that he was capturing because he was a son of the South. His father had been a colonel in the Kentucky Brigade. Griffith was from Kentucky and been born there and raised there, and his father told him Civil War stories before he died. And he had this romanticized view of the old South, and that obviously just totally blended into his movie and his view of everything. But he did argue basically the First Amendment argument. And interestingly, you know, to try to hook some of the things up we've been talking about, is that, you know, the Supreme Court actually weighed in March of 1915 on this new medium of film, because the thinkers of the time weren't sure what to make of it. Does it fall under First Amendment protection or not? I mean, it's just technology we've never seen before, you know, the motion pictures. And in a case that went to the Supreme Court in March of 1915, out of Ohio, where a filmmaker was challenging the state's ability to regulate and ban movies, the very thing we're talking about, censorship, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of regulation and censorship, saying this thing called film, and I'm paraphrasing, is a business, pure and simple. It didn't call it art or anything like that that warranted First Amendment protection. It called it a business, and it said, like any other business, it is subject to regulation. So there's, you know, the biggest legal thinkers of the time giving people like Trotter and anyone else against the film kind of a justification for pursuing that route. It's not considered art in terms of legal analysis. So I found that, again, that's all part of, to me, the wonderful complication of all this great drama that's infused with all these big ideas.
Well, speaking of complication and the fine line between freedom of speech and hate speech, the movie, The Birth of a Nation, was more than just offensive. It was actually a recruitment tool for the Klan.
Yeah, no, it did indeed turn out that way. It actually cuts both ways. It inspired the rebirth of the Klan, and in fact, and it was when the film opened in Atlanta, Georgia, in early December of 1915, a group of men inspired by seeing the film in Atlanta, went out to Stone Mountain outside of Atlanta and burned a cross, and that kind of signaled and marked a rebirth of the Klan in the South, which had been fizzling and fizzled for a number of years. The movie did indeed become a recruiting tool. But interestingly, on the flip side, it also became a recruiting tool in the civil rights movement. Because as I mentioned earlier, the NAACP was founded in 1909 and was still kind of trying to find attraction in its sea legs, so to speak. And in 1915, the protest against the film became an organizing vehicle to rally civil rights activists and people to join the NAACP. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but they're in the book. If you compare the number of branches and the number of members in the NAACP from the beginning of 1915 to the end of 1915, you know, as the movie opened around the country, you'll see a significant spike. There are other factors at play, too, but there's no question that the movie and the protest against it led to a surge in the growth of the NAACP.
The legacy of the film is lasting in both aspects. Your background is in investigative reporting, and you reported extensively on organized crime in Boston, as we've talked about.
Right.
But at one point, you infiltrated the Klan. And
yeah.
There, during your investigation, you found The Birth of a Nation.
Yeah, no, I had a firsthand experience regarding the movie being a recruiting tool. And you're in the late 70s, at the front end of my career as a journalist, I was working in Connecticut at the Hartford Courant. And David Duke, who's got a national profile from Metairie, Louisiana, was at the time the Grand Dragon of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. And he had chosen Connecticut, of all places, to launch a recruiting drive, which got a lot of media publicity during the fall of 1979. And my newspaper, the Hartford Courant, trying to make hay of it, like, what the heck, what kind of response is he getting, and this and that, I was allowed to sort of sign up and under false pretenses, using deception, which is a topic for another day regarding the media, you know, reporting ethics of all that. But be that as it may, I was invited as a new member to meet secretly with Duke when he came to Connecticut in December of 1979. And it was at that meeting where there was just a handful of people. It turned out to be, even though Duke publicly was saying he found 300-400 new members in Connecticut, it was really just a dozen or so. But that his idea of a meeting was to screen The Birth of a Nation. And it's a silent film, obviously, from 1915. But he narrated it in his own extremely racist view, you know, scenes where see how this one white man fights off, you know, 8 N-word ex-slaves and stuff like that. So it was, and so I experienced firsthand now versus then the propaganda value of this film, The Birth of a Nation.
Maybe David Duke got the idea to inflate his numbers from D.W. Griffith, who would hype the number of soldiers, he said, were in the movie of The Birth of a Nation and the amount of money and resources that were spent to make it.
I never made the connection, right, and to exaggerate the number of his foot soldiers in the Klan. Yeah, no, that's interesting.
Griffith's techniques in filmmaking have influenced the language of filmmaking ever since then, and movies would not look the way they do if it were not for his innovations. Probably if not for the success of that film, because they were the first time they were really put all together in an epic sense. But I have to wonder how much they inspired the propagandists that followed him. For instance, not all that many years after, you have Leni Riefenstahl's documentary, Triumph of the Will. It's yet another innovative film, and yet another film that technique is used for disturbing and troubling means. Do you think there's a connection to be made between The Birth of a Nation and the propaganda filmmaking that came out of Nazi Germany?
Oh, I think so, and also just the realization, and Griffith and his cohort, a writer by the name of Thomas Dixon, who wrote the novel upon which the movie was based. The novel was called The Klansman. The movie became known as The Birth of a Nation. They both had a sense of what I think you're getting at is the power of the medium to affect public opinion and to shape it, and to be used as propaganda. And again, the success of the film, I think, demonstrated and showed to other filmmakers and other innovators from different walks of life the potential of this medium to do just that. And amazingly, Thomas Dixon, who was friends with the then president Woodrow Wilson in that era, they had gone to college together. There's a letter, and I quote from it in the book. Dixon wrote to Wilson about the film, and he went on his riff that foreshadowed exactly what you're getting at. Dixon was saying, imagine these film powers, the filmmaking, being repurposed into politics and how the reach it could have and the impact it could have on voters. I mean, so it was really, again, foreshadowing all the different uses the medium has had to shape public opinion, whether it's here or abroad.
And Woodrow Wilson did at least privately hold some acclaim for The Birth of a Nation. As you mentioned, Dixon was involved with Wilson's administration, or at least his political campaigns. He was able to arrange a screening, and Wilson said he liked the movie.
Yeah, no, that's another one. Again, one of these fascinating milestones or features to this drama is that Birth of a Nation, it was the first ever film screened inside the White House. And that was something Dixon, because of his personal relationship with the president, had arranged. And so in and this was before it opened in L.A. Earlier in February, there was this invitation-only screening in the Blue Room of the White House, and Wilson thoroughly enjoyed the evening and thoroughly enjoyed the movie. The filmmakers had quoted from Wilson's own books on American history because Wilson was a scholar and had been president of Princeton, so he was extremely flattered by the whole thing. It came back to bite him later in the year when word got out that he had praised the movie, and it caused him a lot of political consternation. But the fact is that it's the first ever movie screened in the White House. And it's interesting because in terms of bookends, I mean, that's 100 years ago. I think there's quite a contrast that just speaks for itself when a very different movie was screened in the Obama White House, Selma. So you have this two bookends of two movies, White House movies, you know, a century apart that I think speak volumes.
And around the time of the 100th anniversary of The Birth of a Nation, which is inarguably one of the most influential technical films made, the Oscars were held in February, I believe, and Selma was nominated for one, but there was no mention of The Birth of a Nation, even though it was the centennial of the movie.
Yeah, last winter in February, when it was the 100th anniversary of its premiere, which ironically or coincidentally is Black History Month now, yeah, there really wasn't. There were a few, at some of the awards ceremonies, some of the black actors connected the moment to it back then and the struggles we still now all face in the film industry and in society at large, where public discourse is still rife with the kinds of negative depictions of blacks as lawless and violent, the stereotypes that are rooted in the images of Birth of a Nation. There were some references to that, but you're right, the Academy Awards kind of, I think, missed an opportunity to acknowledge that troubled legacy. It's a troubled, problematic film, and I think there's a reviewer in The New Yorker who I think captured it best. He had this line in an article a year or so ago about the film in which he said, "The worst thing about The Birth of a Nation is how good it is."
Dick Lehr's book about that film is also called The Birth of a Nation, subtitled How a Legendary Filmmaker and a Crusading Editor Reignited America's Civil War. We've been talking with Dick Lehr this hour. Dick, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. It was good to be with you.